On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is seeing a massive spread of COVID-19. Governor Evers said Friday people let their guard down on WHBY radio.
Not that I'm a big brother here, but when people aren't wearing a mask and aren't doing the social distancing and things like that, that we all know are important, the virus is going to take over, and it has.
We have the state's chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for communicable diseases, Dr. Ryan Westergaard, with us. What do you want to know about the surge? How has COVID touched your family, your community? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, our state saw a bit of a let up from the surging numbers yesterday, reporting fewer than 2,000 new cases. What can you tell us about the status of the spread?
Well, unfortunately, although yesterday was a slightly lower day, on average over the past week, the data tell us that we're in a worse position than, frankly, we've ever been during this pandemic. We've been averaging upwards of 2,000 cases, and these are spread really throughout the entire state. So there's no region of the state that doesn't have extensive community spread right now, and that's pretty concerning.
What is contributing to the surge?
Well, at the most basic level, this is an extraordinarily contagious virus. So this is what will happen unless we take pretty extraordinary precautions to stop it. The virus spreads from person to person quite easily anytime people are within close contact, such as routine conversation. And what we've learned, the lessons that we've learned over the course of the pandemic is particularly in indoor settings where people are in close proximity, the expectation is that this will spread far and wide unless we are very deliberate and very cautious. You know, those precautions are the things that we talk about in public health that we're trying to get people to adopt on a widespread basis, which are limiting gatherings, you know, wearing face coverings, and by for the most part, staying home and out of close contact with others.
Do you see this as residents letting their guard down, as Governor Evers said there?
I think that's true. You know, we have really good data about the virus, obviously, with all the testing we have. We don't have great ways to track the proportion of people who wear masks and the size of gatherings. That's really up to individual people to make those decisions themselves. But anecdotally, when we talk to health officers around the state, it does seem that people are not taking this as seriously as they should. There's still a lot of areas where mask wearing is not anywhere near universal. And in order for us to turn the corner, that really needs to be our goal. We need to have upwards of 90% of people wearing masks anytime they're around people that aren't part of their household. And we're quite far from that right now, even though we're seeing a big surge. So we clearly need to do much better.
I want to ask you about schools and campuses. Do you think that limiting in-person instruction in our state schools and colleges and universities, is that necessary to stop the high rates of spread infection?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So we've learned some things. We're still in the process of learning things from a number of outbreaks that we've had in college campuses here in Wisconsin. And the first week in September, we saw really a much higher and much larger and much sooner than expected surge in cases on the UW-Madison campus. And there was a pretty aggressive response that seemed to have worked. The number of cases on this campus and a lot of main campuses really turned the corner rather abruptly. Now, the response to that was a number of things. So you don't know any one of them, which was the most likely to be effective. Limiting in-person instruction was one of those. My sense looking at the data, though, it was actually the restricting of gatherings outside of the classroom that made the biggest difference. They were able to trace infections through contact tracing, through dormitories, and through off-campus locations, and they really were deliberate about flowing and stopping those types of gatherings. And that's probably made more of a difference than actually limiting in-person instruction in the classroom.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Wisconsin's chief medical officer, Ryan Westergaard. He's with us as we look at the pandemic, the state of it. Healthcare workers, we want to hear from you. What would you like to share about the pandemic? Do you have the resources necessary to care for COVID patients and to protect yourself? What are you seeing among COVID-19 in friends and family? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard, the seven-day average for people who get tested and are positive for COVID is higher than 17%. What does the high positivity rate indicate?
Well, our goal is to keep the positivity rate as low as possible. And some have used a benchmark of 5%. You know, in the eastern states in the U.S., they've been keeping it low around 1%. And that's really a marker that we're doing enough testing. You know, we know that many people who have this infection are asymptomatic and therefore might not come to medical attention. So if we test enough people, if we test so many people that a very large majority are negative, that gives us more confidence that we're not missing as many. When we have case positivity rates 10%, 15% or higher, it makes us a little more concerned that we're not testing enough people and that the spread in the communities might be more widespread than we realize.
Do you think we are testing enough people now?
I think we are going to need to test more people and in different ways than we have in the past. I think testing is not widespread. It's not universally easily accessible, although it's much better than it has been. People with symptoms are able to get tested through their healthcare providers. There's still a lot of instances that we hear about, though, that people who are in close contact, meaning asymptomatic people who are at risk because they were exposed to the virus, there are a lot of places where they're not getting tested as easily. And because, again, as we mentioned, this infection can spread silently in people without symptoms, we need to have systems where we can test everyone who has symptoms and everyone who might be infected without symptoms. That's what is going to give us the clearest picture of where the virus is spreading and how fast.
I want to talk about the idea of super spreader events, those who infect multiple other people with the virus. It could be an event. It could be something else. What kind of super spreader activity are you monitoring in Wisconsin?
Well, particularly as the weather gets colder and people tend to gather inside more than outdoors, the risk is going to be for transmission in gatherings that involve larger numbers of people. So in both in this country and in other countries that have contained the virus very well, some of the initial hotspots when there have been spikes have been in bars and restaurants, particularly bars where people are in close contact, and if they're drinking, they're not generally wearing a mask, at least all of the time. So I think in Wisconsin, as people tend to gather, you know, indoors, to watch football or to hang out at bars, that's going to pose a real threat. If we want to do those things safely, we need to get a much better handle on transmission of the virus, and that's going to call for increased testing, really being deliberate and intentional about staying home when people are sick and adhering to the quarantine recommendation when people are exposed. We do all these things to try to limit how widespread the virus is spreading. It makes those things safer. But it's probably going to be the case in the coming months that, you know, large indoor gatherings with many people is not going to be a good idea. Those are going to remain dangerous for some time as we go through the cold and flu season.
We have Wisconsin's Chief Medical Officer, Ryan Westergaard, who stays with us as we discuss how the state is addressing combating COVID-19. What questions do you have about the virus? What do you want to know about how and where it's spreading fastest in Wisconsin? Do you wear a mask when you leave home? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back for more State Cap with Dr. Westergaard in a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the State Capitol Report, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reports 81% of the state's hospital beds are filled. The latest two-week snapshot indicates 29 counties are experiencing very high and growing COVID-19 activity. We're discussing the surge with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, the state's epidemiologist for communicable diseases. Dr. Westergaard, how has our state's hospital capacity been changing in this surge? What are you seeing?
The hospital systems around the state have had the luxury of 6 months of time to prepare and think about ways in which they can surge. And by and large, there's an increase in hospital bed utilization, but not a crisis. So we're beginning to see some strain. I put our response, our healthcare, public health response, in really two categories. But the hospital situation is concerning because we're seeing an uptick in hospitalizations and ICU beds, and that could put strain on both staffing and hospital resources. The other part of our response, though, that is beyond strain, it's frankly cracking under the strain, is our local public health infrastructure. So our people who respond to positive tests, do contact tracing, call people when they test positive, call people who have been exposed and give them instructions about how to stay safe and how to quarantine. That system is not able to keep up, and we're in a lot of discussions about how do we support local public health to do their work, because that's the other side, the more upstream, the prevention aspect of our response, and that part's really under strain right now.
Can you put numbers with that? How many more contact tracers do you need in Wisconsin?
Well, it's tricky to estimate because we have 90 plus local and tribal health jurisdictions, and they all have a number of staff, some of which are part-time and some of which are full-time. And they do other things in addition to contact tracing. Mm. So what we hear about our numbers, we were really under strain in July, beginning of August, when we were having 600-700 cases a day. Now that we're in 2,000 cases a day, they're very much struggling to keep up. So probably at least twice as many people as we have, but that's not the only thing that's really concerning. There's a lot of functions that local public health professionals do other than contact tracing. In all of those things, whether it be immunizations or follow-up for other communicable diseases, are all going to be a strain as well. So our public health system is comprised of a lot of really dedicated and hardworking people, but it was frankly too small and too underfunded even before this started. So that's really an unfolding crisis in my view, is that we have to protect all of public health by working together and shrinking this epidemic, because it's putting strain on all parts of the system.
Well, Dr. Westergaard, let's bring in a call now. Mark is joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Hi, if I may, I have two questions. I'll try to be succinct. The vaccine may not be a magic bullet because a reservoir is left in a nasal cavity in studies in apes, so it's still transmissible. The patient, it's out of the lungs, patient feels better. And the second is, what are you doing about getting fast, cheap testing? The world and the state, everybody's lagging way behind on this. And colleges in somewhere in the Midwest, they got it right, and they're doing it for opening their school, and it's working. Those are the questions.
Mark, thank you. Do you want to start with the testing question?
Sure. Sure, be happy to. Thanks, Mark. One of the advances in testing that have allowed a lot of different sectors to get good information quickly is the development of what we call point of care or rapid antigen tests. So these are different than the molecular tests like PCR that we've relied on throughout the bulk of our testing. Antigen tests can be done. Some of them require a small device that sits on a desktop to do a reader, to read the results. It can get in 15 minutes or so. And there's newer ones that just are, a piece of cardboard that give you a result in 5 minutes or so. So these are really useful for the reasons you described. We can get rapid results in a lot different settings, and they can be mass produced. So there are millions, hundreds of millions of these devices available now. In Wisconsin, we're getting an allocation of approximately $2 million from the federal government, and we are making those available to both healthcare systems and other organizations that are able to use them for testing. So the future looks brighter in that regard, provided that we use all the different types of tests that are available and use them well, according to the instructions and understand some of the limitations with respect to accuracy. Your first question, Mark, was about vaccines, and I think you're right that, you know, we are likely to have a safe and effective vaccine, but few vaccines are extremely effective, and many are only partially effective. So the whether it's a game changer remains to be seen. I think we're optimistic that we'll have a vaccine that provides, that confers some protection, that lowers the risk of infection, and that can have a pretty substantial effect on transmission in the community if it's widely adopted. But it will be, like all the things we discussed, one tool in our toolkit that we have to use in a widespread way as we can in order to make sure that it has the maximum effect.
Let's bring in Becky now, joining us from Barron County this morning. Hi, Becky.
Hi, good morning. So I have a comment. We've been told in Barron County that if one member of the family tests positive, the rest of the family does not need to be tested because you can just assume they're positive as well. And I'm concerned that that's skewing the numbers down rather than really telling the truth about how many people have it.
Becky, thanks. Yeah, Dr. Westergaard, what do you make of that?
Yeah, thanks, Becky. Our recommendation is for people who have been in close contact to be tested. And the reason for this is, while it's true that the risk of infection is high, not everyone in a household setting will necessarily become infected. And if we can test everybody and understand who is infected and who's not infected, we can potentially prevent transmission by separating people, by staying outside the homes. This is what isolation means for people who are infected, and quarantine means for those who are uninfected. So it serves a really important role for keeping people safe by testing people who have been exposed to understand how do we break those chains of transmission. So our recommendation and the CDC recommendation, we here at the state recommend testing for people who are exposed, and then isolation for people who have been exposed, regardless of whether their test is positive.
Do you find that there is uniformity in how counties are carrying out their messaging on the spread of COVID?
I think there's some variability based on resources and local constraints, particularly when it comes to the ability to do the system of contact tracing and notifying people who've been exposed. Everyone's working with different amounts of resources, and the context locally is different, so it looks a little bit differently. We work pretty hard, and have a pretty collaborative environment with local health officers and us at the state to try to maintain a good communication, so we know what the science tells us is the best strategies. So we have multiple opportunities every week to have a local forum where we answer questions from health officers, similar to what we do at the federal level at the CDC. So it's not perfect, but there's pretty strong attempts at trying to maintain good collaboration communication so we stay on the same page with these recommendations, which frankly can evolve over time as new evidence emerges.
Let's bring in Saul, who is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Saul, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. My question is, and I want to thank you for all the information that you're giving us, what about touching things like food, going to the grocery store, going to the produce department? I want to thank all of our grocery stores in the state for bringing the food out, and loading it in our cars, all this other stuff. But can we go shopping? Can we touch food? Can we touch surfaces? Please, doctor.
Sure. Thanks, all. Excellent question. Respiratory viruses like coronavirus and flu and the common cold virus, we know from a lot of history that they can survive on surfaces. We call this fomite transmission. And that has been a concern throughout the response. But as time has gone by and we've looked at the settings where transmission seems to happen, these so-called super spreader events, it seems for this particular virus, this novel coronavirus, that the majority of spread seems to be person-to-person respiratory transmission. So we can't say that it's impossible that it can be contracted by touching a contaminated surface, but it certainly would be a very, very small minority of the true cases. So I think the answer to your question is yes, we can go shopping, we can eat, take out food. We should just do the normal precautions that we do for preventing the spread of germs in all settings. So disinfecting surfaces that people touch frequently and washing hands. I think just with those things, we can make casual contact much safer and reduce the risk of that sort of what we call fomite transmission. The real risk is respiratory transmission, respiratory droplets. And that's why we need to do things so much differently than we have done with other respiratory virus seasons and wear masks really universally.
Dr. Westergaard, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues. We have State Senator Lena Taylor. Milwaukeeans, what do you want to ask your State Senator? What can you share about your health and your economic hit from COVID? How do you want state lawmakers to act now? Your line is 800-642-1234. There's more State Cap with State Senator Lena Taylor right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On this State Capitol Report, we're discussing how to combat COVID-19 and the politics in play. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, they filed a brief last week in support of a lawsuit that challenges Governor Evers' emergency order and statewide mask mandate. What do you think of the mask mandate? Should it stay or go? How could lawmakers slow the spread of the virus? Healthcare workers, what can you share about COVID? We're at 800-642-1234. State Senator Lena Taylor represents District 4, covering the areas north of Milwaukee, including Shorewood, Glendale, and Wauwatosa. Senator Taylor, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, as you look at Milwaukee County, you know, the spread of COVID has been kind of up and down with cases, although they are overall lower than they were in the summer. How has the pandemic been affecting people in your district?
The pandemic has been devastating for individuals, whether it is business owners who have had to close and then try to reopening, really based on not as many supports as were needed, especially early on. There have been more supports on this back end, but individuals not receiving their unemployment compensation have been, you know, devastating for families. And the fact that there are so many individuals who are without the essential things that they need, housing, food, those things alone are challenging. Many people are without work. And then on top of all of that, the individuals in one of the communities in particular in the city of Milwaukee, where I was born and raised and live, the number of individuals that have tested positive and people who have passed away have been great. Many hotspots, right in the middle of Milwaukee and my district. So it's been very challenging. I was just had my little cousins who are 5 and 6 stay all night with me the other night. And they were like, you know, making it very clear that they're really not feeling this virtual school thing, that they miss their friends.
Sure. What would you like to see as you look around to your fellow lawmakers? How can the legislature mitigate this public health crisis?
Well, one of the things we could do is come in session, meet, discuss the things that are happening in our districts and in our communities and what we would be able to do in order to address those issues. I think it's very, in my opinion, irresponsible of leaders who are pushing so hard against the things that matter, like the mask mandate, the use of masks, suggesting and fighting so hard about schools making the choice to be virtual versus being in person, not coming in so that we can create consequences for parents who send their children to school knowing that they are positive for coronavirus. That the risk that gives to other individuals is just truly unnecessary and unwarranted. You know, how do we put people in a position so that they are encouraged to do the things to help save everybody's life?
Republicans have been vocal in their opposition to the mask mandate and the extension of the emergency order. Are you concerned that these disagreements will have an effect on public compliance with the order?
I do believe that when you have leaders who are a part of pushing back on something that is solely for the purpose of trying to reduce the spread of the virus, that it does send mixed messages, wrong messages. I do believe when leaders do not prioritize to come in to meet, to do the people's business, that it does send the wrong message, especially when they can come in and literally fill the same building, the People's House, with 100 to 200 plus people in order to hear a partisan speech, from a national secretary. It is troubling for me to not see leaders stand up and encourage the behavior that we want to see.
We're talking with State Senator Lena Taylor as she's with us to discuss the state of the pandemic in Wisconsin, the economic fallout. How has the recession affected you and your family? How would you like state government to address the financial impacts of the coronavirus pandemic? Have you received unemployment assistance? How long have you been waiting? Join into the conversation. Your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Senator Taylor, you talked about housing earlier. You mentioned, housing insecurity, a huge issue. And Princeton University's Eviction Lab data shows that more than 4,000 households in Milwaukee have faced eviction since the pandemic started. How can state lawmakers address the issues of housing insecurity and eviction?
So one of the things that that's happened is there's been some supports through the state, through the county, and through very late in the game, the city of Milwaukee, in regards to people who are facing evictions. Only most recently did the county do something to help homeowners. And so in both of those groups, renters and homeowners, both are put in a position to need help. One, because homeowners may not be collecting rent because individuals may not know the federal help that came that has put a moratorium on evictions. So one of the things that we could do as government is meet in the legislature so that we can talk about the different places that individuals have needs. I've said this often. One of the reasons I ran for mayor in the city of Milwaukee is that instead of the city allowing properties to sit vacant for 2 and 3 years, like the house that was next door to me, we could do a better job of using the stock, the housing stock that's in the city, before it gets to the place that we are allowing it to deteriorate, so that individuals in the community are complaining about, these abandoned houses. So we could use those to also help people in order to change that. And the state could do some type of programming to be able to help people not only become homeowners, but to incentivize doing something to help our most vulnerable populations. I mean, we were able to all of a sudden care about the people, so to say, underneath the freeway when we thought that the DNC convention was going to be in Milwaukee, when we didn't want people to see the tent city under the highway. That same mindset is what we should use every day to be able to help people, whether we're in the middle of COVID-19 or not.
People not being able to pay their rent is one thing, but, landlords may be saying, well, hey, we need these dollars to continue to keep these rental units open and functioning and up to code. So, it doesn't just stop at the renter.
You are exactly right. And that's why I mentioned earlier that there is only one place, and that's the county, Milwaukee County, that I'm aware of, that's done something to help individuals who are presently homeowners and are facing foreclosure or challenges because of COVID-19. And because there is a moratorium on evictions, my goodness, it should have been a moratorium on foreclosures. Or at the very least, it should have been a mechanism put in place to be able to help people so that people are not losing their homes. Now, don't get me wrong. Mortgage companies have been doing things themselves also, putting people's payments on the back end of their loan, doing things to defer their payments until a certain time period. But then in some situations, you still have to come up with a lump sum, and in others, it's put on the back end. But the other issue is that if, as legislators, we are not coming and we are not meeting in the legislature, we're not prioritizing the people's business, then it also becomes very difficult to put that kind of mass information out, especially for someone like myself who is running for reelection at this time. I can't send anything out that goes to more than 48 people. So that creates the, you know, less than 50 people. So that creates a challenge for even communicating messages to your constituents.
Let's bring in a call now. Saul is joining us from Stevens Point this morning. Hi, Saul.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Saul.
How do you do? My problem is the legislature goes running to the courts, spending lots of money, state money and legal fees, when they could meet and legislate what they're so worried about. But they won't do it because they don't want to get stuck with the blame when things go south. So I'm really upset that the legislature does all this legal stuff and they could very simply just pass legislation that would take those powers away from the governor if they don't think he should have them.
So, Saul, very concerned about the litigious nature that he sees among the legislators.
Saul has hit the ball out of the park. The legislature has full control to do the people's business. And the amount of money that their friends and their supporters are making in the law firms for the court proceedings that they're doing have been outrageous amounts. And at this time, where we do not have as much revenue that's coming into the state, when there are counties and municipalities and villages that are challenged financially, this is not the time for the state legislature to be spending money irresponsibly by going to the courts when, if you feel that strongly about it, come on in. Come in. You have the ability to do whatever you want. As the Republican legislature, they have that ability. They have the votes in order to do that. They've shown us that over and over again when they've changed the rules in the middle of the game, when they've denied, you know, individuals to be able to have the access to even speak on the floor of the legislature on behalf of their constituents, like what happened to myself and Senator Carpenter by President Roth and Senator Fitzgerald. So I couldn't even get Senator Fitzgerald to return a call in the 17 years we've worked together. That never happened. So I must say I'm disappointed, and I think Saul hit it out the park.
State Senator Lena Taylor with us on this edition of the State Capitol Report. We're discussing the health and economic consequences of COVID, the growing political rift on how to contain it. You're aligned to the senator, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More State Cap here on the Ideas Network. Let's get back to the State Capitol Report now. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Steve is with us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is this, with this preface. There's been a lot of rhetoric. I know it's on both sides, but specifically I want to talk about the Democratic side. Nancy Pelosi basically calling for uprising. Joe Biden making a comment that he would like to take the president outside the woodshed. Biden also saying that, you know, the officers in the Jacob Blake shooting should have been charged before an investigation was complete. I just want to know, since President Trump has always asked the question, I want to know if the senator will condemn the rhetoric used by the Democratic
Party. Steve, I'm going to jump in here because, you know, we're talking about the State Capitol Report, not the national scene. But Senator Taylor, how would you like to respond?
I think the first thing I'd like to say is, Steve, this is way beyond some partisan politics game that you want to play on condemning one thing or another. Joe Biden has shown nothing but leadership on this issue, from everything from wearing a mask to saying a plan that we should do in order to move our nation from this horrific place that President Trump has put us in. And in regards to Nancy Pelosi or what she has said, I will defer to the fact that I have the Speaker of the Assembly to listen to and deal with, and the Majority Leader in the Senate. I'll leave Nancy Pelosi to Tammy Baldwin, Ron Johnson, and Gwen Moore, my congressperson, and what things say. But I will say that I've seen leadership there also, and very candidly, always having on a face mask, always having it nearby on her neck if necessary, and the leadership to say the things that we need to do to help the people. They went in the Congress and did the people's business. And in regards to the Jacob Blake shooting, you know, I have to say to you, if you are not outdone by seven shots in front of children, in front of the community, if you don't believe that there needs to be a different mindset in how we proceed with how we police, there is no question that we need law enforcement. But I will say this to you. I want to come in the legislature, and I sat in that chamber to do the people's business around policing in Wisconsin, where, thank you very much, I have watched from Ernest Lacey all the way to Jacob Blake's shooting, and in Milwaukee in particular, the kind of behavior that has to change. No one came to do the people's business. So, no, I don't want to participate in the circus of talking about it and playing those games. I want us to be on the floor and do the work. So I find it so sad that there are people out there like Steve who want to digress into what won't take us to the solutions to make it where we stop more of these deaths that are happening by not only Americans, but Wisconsinites, and that we're not doing something to help businesses.
Senator Taylor, Speaker Robin Voss formed this task force on racial disparities last month that is being led by your colleagues in the Assembly. What legislation would you like to see emerge from that task force?
So I believe the task force is already on the wrong chart, so to say, or the wrong path. The name of the task force is great, right? Dealing for them to deal with racial disparities. The problem is that the racial disparity issue really is rooted in a lack of value of Black lives, period. And so it shows itself in the Capitol, for example, where there are no Black staff in most people's offices and never have been, and probably never will be for many people. It's in the building where there are not Black staff in so many other departments and agencies. Shucks, it was even with our own governor when he had no Black staff. And you could see it in the picture that he put out for Women's International Day, not to mention very limited number, about maybe, and not even quite the number of people that even Scott Walker had, not at the number of Jim Doyle and others. So Black Lives Mattering is something that we all have to contend with, and the disparities are across the board for Wisconsin. So I don't know that I agree with their first quote-unquote area that they want to do. I believe we can walk and chew gum at the same time in order to deal with disparities, and you can't narrow it to just policing. And then I'll end with, you know, I also don't believe we need another task force. I think what we need are the things and the principles and the things in place, like what's been asked of the governor and not delivered on by him, is the kinds of infrastructure that would be in place to deal with disparities, you know, from here on. So, for example, racial disparity reports, just like we give a fiscal report on every piece of legislation, racial disparity impact statements that could exist not only at the state level, the county and local levels, accountability for discrimination in our state. My own city doesn't have a way, which is why we probably are hyper-segregated, to deal with discrimination. And the mayor doesn't put money in his budget in order to fund people to deal with EEOC issues. So this is really about a mindset, and I'm going to, you know, kind of hopefully help Steve in this way. This is an issue that is a problem for Democrats and Republicans alike. But I will at least say, for me, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are hitting the nail on the head by saying these are issues and that we have to make sure that the phrase liberty and justice for all is true for all Americans. All Americans.
We're talking with State Senator Lena Taylor as we look at issues in Wisconsin, the economic fallout of COVID. Taking another call now, Mo is joining us from Oconto. Hi, Mo.
Hello, and thank you, Ms. Taylor, for being there today. My thought is kind of this. We've all worked with people who don't have a plan of their own, but they'll tear down everybody else's. And I understand they're trying to protect our freedoms, our freedom not to attend a game at Lambeau Field, a freedom to divert education money to paying for PPE, and the freedom to stay home to take care of your kid instead of going to work. I think what people need to do is just like you're going to hire a contractor. It doesn't matter what bumper sticker he has in his car. Who's going to do the best job? And that's what we need people to look at right now.
I agree with you completely that we need to be looking at what's going to put us in the best position to reduce the spread of coronavirus, what is going to put us in the best position in order to help our people who are struggling from this, and what's going to put us in the strongest position in order to be able to make sure our next generation even exists, in order to be able to participate. And if we aren't doing those things, then I do believe that we're falling flat on our face. And although I agree with you that in the concept of that it doesn't matter, right, what bumper sticker someone has or doesn't have, I'm not feeling some of the stickers I saw, for example, in Milwaukee on some contractors that, you know, represent that they supported white supremacists and that they were promoting hate and that type of thing. But I get the concept. We want people who are going to respect our scientists, their expertise, to be leaders and to exhibit the kind of behavior that suggests that we support what they're saying and we respect what they're saying, so the health professionals around the state won't step down, like in some areas, because they've been disrespected as if what they're doing is not best for the people, and in communities where they don't want to hear from the scientists.
I want to jump in here because we're almost out of time, Senator Taylor, and reading your recent column about keeping the faith and losing the faith, and you wrote about the faith in the application of the Constitution, the voting system, our democracy, all of that wavering. How are you keeping your faith and finding hope this year?
I have to say to you, it's been challenging for even myself, but as a woman of faith, it truly has been through prayer. It truly has been through serving people. I can't speak for anyone else, but, you know, going out and helping to give food to the community, it rejuvenizes. It gives me a different level of rejuvenation that I have to say that I appreciate. So I've just been trying to do the things to support my family, help my family, try to stay safe, try to help my constituents. Literally, if I'm doing emails at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, because if someone's emailing me, even on a weekend, it matters for me to respond to them.
Senator Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And you have a great day, Kate.
You too. Lena Taylor, representing District 4 in Milwaukee. Just ahead, it's Mondays with Mike. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report. You're listening to the Ideas Network.